Hi everyone. Thanks for tuning into the M 2.0 series of AMSA's Ampule podcast. My name is Ray Shen and I will be your host for today's episode with special guest Dr. David Griffin. Dr. Griffin is an infectious diseases fellow at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and he was generous enough to sit down with me today for an interview about the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. There is no denying that this pandemic is one of the most pivotal events we have encountered in recent history. And in this episode, we discuss the pandemic from a doctor's perspective, as well as speculate on the progression and likely future of the virus in Australia. Before we begin this podcast, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we reside here in what is now known as Australia, the place of recording. I extend my respects to elders of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, past, present, and emerging. AMSA acknowledges that the sovereignty of this land has never been ceded, and that this land always was and always will be Aboriginal land. All right, so without further ado, I will now introduce Dr. David Griffin.
I'm only human, can you see? I made a mistake. Please just look me in my face. Tell me everything's okay. 'Cause I got it. Ooh, never be like you.
So my name is David Griffin. I'm an infectious diseases fellow at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne. That largely this year has involved working directly with the COVID response, but obviously usually would cover a full breadth of infectious diseases work.
So would you be able to tell us a bit about what an ID physician kind of does, like what their role is?
Yeah, so the role of an ID physician is quite broad. We are, obviously involved in the day-to-day care of patients, particularly those with complicated infections. I guess some of the spectrum of patients that we would work with on a daily basis include some that are often marginalized, and they include patients who inject drugs, patients with HIV infection, refugees, patients with tuberculosis. We also help to manage complicated infections in patients in the intensive care unit who have had organ transplantation, who have cancer, who have weakened immune systems. And then another big portion of our role is in infection control. So trying to prevent the spread of infections in the healthcare setting, and also the prevention of multi-drug resistant organisms. And that sort of a big part of that is antimicrobial stewardship. So making sure that people are using the right antibiotics in the right patient for the right period of time.
Okay. All right. So that sounds like quite a extensive range of roles. Would you be able to elaborate a bit on how you are involved in infectious disease control specifically?
Within the healthcare setting, there's a number of things we do, and certainly we don't do it alone. There's in most hospitals, there are built-in infection control units, and often they're heavily staffed by nurses and nurse practitioners with experience in infection control. And a big part of that is keeping track of infections in the hospital. So that they include, for example, keeping a track of the number of patients who have an operation that then subsequently get a surgical site infection, either of the skin or deeper, keeping a track of the patients in intensive care who get a ventilator-associated pneumonia. But they also provide advice on how to manage patients in the hospital, for example, with influenza or other respiratory viral infections, or, for example, with tuberculosis, to prevent the spread of that infection to other patients and healthcare staff. or healthcare workers within the hospital setting. And so again, the combination of both surveillance, so keeping a track of what's happening, but then also acting on that information and our understanding of various infectious diseases to prevent them from actually spreading between patients and healthcare workers.
Right. So would you be involved in the hospital's policy for specifically for new diseases like COVID?
Yeah, certainly. So we're often a point of contact for the hospital executive around guiding responses to new and emerging infectious diseases. Obviously, in conjunction with the Department of Health, we would certainly help to design policies around treatment and infection control, you know, how to move those patients and manage those patients in the healthcare setting. Because, you know, it goes far beyond simply just the bedside day-to-day care of these patients. There is sort of a lot of logistical issues that have to be sorted out in terms of, you know, mitigating that risk of transmission, ensuring that rooms are adequately cleaned between patients, and sort of employing other strategies to prevent the spread again between patients and sort of healthcare workers and the other staff of the hospital.
Okay, and would you be able to tell us a bit about your experiences as part of the hospital's response to adapt to the COVID outbreak?
Yeah, I think that's a it's a great question. So I guess one of the challenges with COVID is that it was a new and it was a new respiratory viral infection that we kind of had to learn a lot on the run. Certainly, there were systems in place that were based on experience with things like influenza, Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, or MERS. And the original SARS coronavirus, and so and more recently, I guess with Ebola, there have been sort of systems in place for the in-hospital management of these infections, both from a logistical perspective, but also a sort of an initial patient management perspective. So we're certainly involved in a lot of the preliminary discussions around that and preparing the hospital for, you know, various scenarios that we expected that we might encounter with COVID.
Yeah. And so how does the COVID response look like in a hospital? For example, I understand you're part of a like specific COVID unit as well.
Yeah, that's right. So we obviously, the ID unit have been involved in a lot of the preparation and guidelines around managing patients with coronavirus infection. In terms of what that actually looks like, I think, you know, we as a hospital had to sort of come together and work out what would be best both for our patients, you know, and their care, but also sort of develop the structures that worked best for our hospital as well. And so, you know, we sort of had to come together and sort of in sort of a multidisciplinary fashion, sort of work out which teams were, you know, in the hospital were best set to care for particular types of patients with coronavirus. And, you know, that involved obviously discussions between various specialist medical teams, including our general medical units, our respiratory unit, the infectious diseases unit. But then also our critical care specialties, you know, intensive care, the emergency department. We had to also ensure that patients who needed surgery who had coronavirus, you know, there were policies and procedures in place to allow our surgical colleagues and anaesthetics colleagues to safely provide these patients with the care that they needed and deserved. And so it's a definitely sort of multi-system, multi-layered sort of approach to designing the systems that would ensure that these patients could be provided with the best and safest care possible.
Okay. So basically, you know, different demographics of patients would be treated by different teams.
Yeah. So for example, you know, some of our older patients who had coronavirus infection, you know, with multiple medical comorbidities, the people who are, you know, best experienced to care for them are those often within general medicine. you know, general medicine is a specialty where, you know, most patients, you know, essentially that specializes in the management of sort of complex and interacting medical comorbidities. And so, you know, we as a group felt that they were best to continue to care for that group of patients. Likewise, our respiratory colleagues, you know, have extensive experience and knowledge around the management of complicated respiratory failure. And we're sort of best served to look after patients where that respiratory failure was a dominant issue.
Okay. So would you be able to tell us a bit about just your experiences and observations from treating COVID patients?
I guess one of the real challenges in treating COVID patients that we came across from the start was that, you know, again, this was a new virus that we didn't really have a lot of experience. And certainly there wasn't any real evidence to start with to help guide what exactly best care for these people looked like. And so, you know, obviously we have a lot of experience with managing other viral pneumonias. But, you know, in terms of having, you know, the best quality evidence to manage patients with COVID-19 specifically, that simply didn't exist. And I guess, you know, that in itself brought a lot of issues to the table, because as clinicians, what we want to do is we want to do something. You know, when patients are sick in front of you, you want to help to make them better. And I think that in itself kind of poses challenges, because, you know, often we want to do something, but at the same time that's sort of balanced against this sort of risk of, you know, inadvertent harm by doing things that we think would be of benefit, but actually we don't have that understanding. And that was a real challenge initially, because we didn't really have good treatments, and we still don't have great treatments for coronavirus, although we've sort of learned things along the way. And as doctors, we're obviously trained as evidence-based practitioners. We try to take sort of the evidence garnered from experience and studies and apply that to the patients that are in front of us. But I guess, that when that doesn't exist, that sort of desire to do something sometimes takes over. And I guess what we saw was sort of a lot of push to use experimental drugs. And I guess in an Australian setting, we very early on said that these drugs should be used sort of in clinical trials, so that we could prospectively collect that data if it were appropriate to give a treatment to a patient. And then we could use that experience to then improve the care of future patients. And I guess that that real sort of balance between our sort of evidence-based and rational approach, we were sort of conflicted with this desire to do something, or this sort of emotional approach, which had the potential to do inadvertent harm to these patients. Thankfully, we now have some evidence for some treatments that do provide modest benefit in patients with more, you know, moderate to severe coronavirus, and they're the drugs like remdesivir. And now it looks like also dexamethasone, and perhaps some of the monoclonal antibodies might have benefit in particular patients. But I guess that was a really interesting, experience to see happen. You know.
All right. So following on from that, my next question is about, you know, our response to this pandemic has been like, it's a very recent and sudden pandemic, and, you know, the response has had to adapt a lot over just a short period of time. But I guess, are you already now seeing changes, the effects of these changes in your hospital care? Like, for example, when you see a patient with COVID come in now versus at the beginning of the pandemic, how much differently do you feel about the prospects of, you know, successfully treating that patient?
Yeah, I think we've definitely gained experience in treating these patients. And I think, you know, we're always more comfortable treating things that we know. I think one of the challenges early on is that there wasn't a lot of that experience. And so I guess every patient was new, both for the senior members of the medical team, but also for the more juniors in the medical team, and also for, you know, the nursing staff. And so we had to, along the way, sort of learn on the run and try to learn from other people's experience overseas and sort of navigate the rapidly emerging literature around coronavirus 19 or COVID-19. And so I guess the short answer is that, you know, we're much more confident and comfortable with managing patients with COVID in the healthcare setting now than we were perhaps in March when we first started seeing these patients. But we're still learning a lot as we go. And we certainly don't have the same experience that, you know, clinicians in New York and Italy and now the Southern United States would have.
Okay. So I guess another thing I wanted to talk about was, how does this pandemic kind of compare to the other, you know, big pandemics throughout history?
So we've certainly, I think our experience with previous pandemics clearly puts us in a better position to deal with this one. And we've learned sort of a variety of lessons along the way from other pandemics that we can then apply to COVID-19. You know, there are then obviously nuances to this pandemic as well that, you know, we have had to learn on the run and hopefully we'll then be able to apply to the future pandemics because they surely will arise. But, you know, for example, if we look back to, you know, quarantine, you know, quarantine is a term that comes from the Venetian language. It's sort of from quarantina, which means 40 days. And the whole idea was is that people arriving into Venetian ports back in the 1300s, in a time where Europe was being ravished by, you know, by plague, they would essentially have to wait on their boats for 40 days off the coast prior to being allowed on shore. And so that, you know, certainly the process of quarantine long predates that. So, you know, we've clearly learned things even from, you know, bubonic plague in the, you know, in the early 14th century. Likewise, you know, this isn't the first time Australia has closed its borders. Australia imposed maritime quarantine in the 1918 influenza pandemic. And so that was thought to have helped Australia, you know, miss out on the first wave of the so-called Spanish influenza of 1918. Similarly, you know, our experience with the HIV pandemic shows that, you know, words matter. People have, you know, applied lots of names to COVID-19, things like, you know, the China virus, you know, and those things, they're not particularly helpful. They don't really help to explain much about the virus itself. They don't, you know, they certainly don't help us to work together to focus on fighting the virus. They probably promote xenophobia. And certainly, I guess you can see, you know, the occasional sort of political point scoring by using these sorts of terms, but by and large, they're not helpful. More recently, obviously, the original SARS, we've learned a great deal from the early SARS epidemic in the early 2000s. Certainly, the knowledge that we gained around that SARS coronavirus provided a platform for us to sort of a starting point for our understanding of this one. Certainly there are differences both clinically and biologically, but, you know, it was a starting point that some of those systems were already in place that people could pick up and sort of take off with, including some sort of early vaccine platforms. Yeah, so I think, you know, we're certainly better placed to deal with this pandemic, having dealt with, you know, these previous ones.
Yeah, okay. I guess because, you know, obviously medical technology is the most advanced it's ever been now, but I guess there are also a number of factors with this pandemic that make it more difficult. Like, for example, the nature of this virus, the way it spreads, and also, you know, we have much increased globalization these days.
Oh, certainly. I think that, you know, we're in a very difficult time. I mean, we're in a great time, you know, compared with, say, the flu pandemic of 1918. You know, we didn't really have we didn't really have well-established intensive care units. We didn't have, you know, antibiotics if they were needed. And so, you know, we're fundamentally better placed from a medical perspective to care for these critically unwell, unwell people. But likewise, we're also, you know, in a world dominated by social media. And I guess something that we've sort of seen, you know, is we've got a very educated population, a population with access to information, and, you know, people who potentially have a platform from which they can sort of disseminate both facts and misinformation as well. And so that, you know, we've had to sort of navigate that as well and ensure that that sort of messaging that is getting out is correct, it's accurate, and, you know, it's disseminated appropriately into a multitude of cultures and people.
Okay. So do you think there is anything that we as doctors or medical students can contribute to this pandemic response? You know, obviously, aside from obviously directly treating patients.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a variety of things that doctors and medical students can contribute to COVID-19 and the response. An obvious one is knowledge. Clearly, you know, we sort of have at least a fundamental understanding of epidemiology and the virus, and certainly we have a capacity to search the literature to find reliable sources and help to communicate that to patients, friends, and family. I think, you know, also we can provide an example to our friends and family. So a really important part of managing COVID-19 is social distancing. And while it's really difficult, the evidence demonstrates quite clearly that, you know, there is the potential for transmission prior to symptoms onset. And so social distancing is sort of a key component, along with sort of identification and sort of isolation of patients with coronavirus to actually preventing spread. And so being an example to others is another clear one. I think the experience that we have and the knowledge that we have, you know, can be taken up by agencies like the Department of Health. And so a lot of medical students have found themselves working within the Department of Health to help trace down contacts. And I mean, from a medical learning perspective, it's actually quite a useful experience taking that exposure and social history. So it's sort of a useful exercise for both the response, but also for medical student learning. Lots of junior doctors have found themselves as part of COVID teams, managing patients with COVID that they might not ordinarily have done, or again, being involved in sort of teams of people who are helping with contact tracing in hospitals or communicating results to patients who might have already been discharged. In terms of other community participation, I guess contributing to dialogue around, you know, some of the issues that arise related to coronavirus. I guess there's a capacity to directly donate time or to donate money to sort of fund foundations and funds that might help people who are disadvantaged by COVID-19 to actually to participate in the same sort of social distancing and sort of efforts to reduce spread. So, yeah, a variety of sort of places, at least at the local level, that medical students and junior doctors can help advocate. I guess, you know, we've obviously seen at sort of more senior levels the role of more senior experienced epidemiologists and public health infectious diseases physicians in terms of managing the response at a national level as well, and even an international level as part of the WHO. So a multifaceted and multi-tiered approach right from the local to global level in terms of a role for doctors and medical students.
Right. So the next few questions I had were in response to the new outbreak in Victoria that's resulted in Melbourne undergoing the second lockdown. So the date today is July 13th. And yeah, since I talked to you a bit last week, the numbers have been kind of increasing in quite an alarming manner. Would you be able to comment on the difference between this outbreak and, you know, the original one we had back in March? I guess, for example, like there seems to be more community transmission in this recent outbreak.
No, I think that's a really important point. You know, as you mentioned, things have changed quite quickly since last time we spoke. The numbers we've seen in Victoria this week have been unprecedented, at least the Australian experience. Certainly still a small drop in the ocean compared with many countries around the world, but important to jump onto that quite quickly and institute the things that have been done to ensure that it doesn't spread like it did overseas. I think one of the things we've learned throughout this is just how infectious COVID is. And so, as you mentioned, you know, one of the big differences this time, and some people are calling this actually the first wave, because the big difference between the numbers we're seeing now, which are greater than they were last time, is that actually these are mostly community transmission, whereas previously the vast majority of cases that we were seeing were actually in people who'd returned from overseas. And, you know, that has all sorts of implications because it means the contact tracing is now actually much harder to do. There's obviously more of it, but, you know, people have many more community exposures and potential sources and also potentials for onward transmission. So I don't envy the task of our contact tracers, although I participate in it myself. You know, I really don't envy those people who do it all day, every day.
Right, okay. So in some ways, this is actually Australia's real first wave.
Some people are calling it that.
Okay. Yeah, I guess if we're counting in terms of like community transmission, I guess my next question would be, you know, what implications does this have regarding our chances of managing the new outbreak? For example, I guess would the measures we took to kind of manage control the initial outbreak be as effective here?
I suspect so. You know, I think the things that we've seen overseas that have worked to tackle coronavirus are really social distancing, you know, at times lockdowns, and then the detection and isolation of positive patients. But it's really all those things in concert that have the, you know, the biggest impact. You know, recently, obviously, we've also seen the introduction of guidance around mask wearing in the community, particularly where you can't socially distance. And you know, every bit helps. So, you know, it'll be useful to see that in conjunction with those other, what I think are much more important elements to this. So, you know, where possible, people should still try to socially distance. But where they can't, for example, in healthcare, you know, it's much more difficult in healthcare to socially distance, that, you know, masks are worn in those instances.
Yeah. So you're saying that judging off the data from overseas outbreaks, which clearly they have much more experience in this, like numbers like the ones we're having right now, it seems feasible that we could contain them.
I mean, I think that's what the experience overseas shows. You know, the numbers we're seeing in Australia, while they're alarming, you know, and again, they've not been seen here, they're a fraction of what was being seen in some countries who subsequently instituted lockdowns, you know, mandated social distancing, all of those sorts of things, in some instances, mask wearing in public to reduce that transmission. And so I have every faith that we will be able to contain this. I don't think, you know, we're not under the impression that this is out of control.
Okay. And I guess, so that does seem like a very, quite reassuring. Another concern I do have, though, is that a key difference that we do have in the situation here compared to overseas is that Australia is kind of in this situation now where we haven't really had a big outbreak before, but we have gone through the experience of going through 3 months of lockdown. And so people are kind of not only frustrated at the measures they've had to go under, but also, you know, because it worked so well, they may not appreciate how important it is to continue lockdown.
I think we have touched on this this notion of sort of complacency, and I think it has been a real danger that, you know, and it's been really hard to maintain that sort of messaging consistently, because I think the first wave, if you like, you know, the numbers were large at the time, nothing, you know, like we're seeing at the moment, but we didn't see the widespread transmission that was predicted in Australia. And I think, you know, that speaks to the fact that the public health strategies that we implemented worked. But the danger of that is that people didn't experience firsthand the consequences of, you know, widespread coronavirus transmission that they saw overseas. And so, you note, it only takes a brief look at social media to see conspiracy theorists, you know, suggesting that coronavirus doesn't exist, you know, it's a means of government sort of controlling the population, those sorts of things, or, you know, ideas around, you know, a lack of transparency and, you know, thoughts that, you know, we're making a big deal out of nothing. And so ensuring that we're really engaging people and they understand the seriousness of the situation, I think, is a really important part of that public health messaging. And I saw this week a shift in gears, if you like, whereby the terminology, particularly in Victoria, changed. And I know, you know, Professor Sutton and Premier Dan Andrews distinctly changing the way that they were describing the front line in the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. And that shift really moved towards putting the responsibility in everyone's hands, in that, you know, we are all fighting a common enemy here. This is, you know, it's not easily seen. Its impacts possibly are, but, you know, it really is everyone's responsibility to work together to minimize the impact of this coronavirus. And our healthcare workers are really the last line of defense. And actually, it's quite an interesting way of framing it, but I think that hopefully will be a really good sort of public health message, that it is everyone's responsibility rather than sort of the government and the healthcare workers' responsibility to contain this.
Right. So it's actually kind of the terminology shifted from describing like healthcare workers as the front line to just describing, you know, the community as the front line. Is that?
That's right. Yeah. So put the responsibility back in the hands of the individual.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think that kind of terminology is actually really important.
I guess with the previous messaging, it was really easy to sort of place blame on a group or, you know, a particular part of the state or of the city. Whereas now, you know, that message is quite clear. And I think it's a good one that, you know, everyone needs to participate in this. Everyone is being impacted by it in some way. And it's everyone's responsibility to make sure they're doing their part. And that is, socially distancing where possible. With the slightest symptoms, getting a test to know that they're negative. If their symptoms persist or get worse, they get retested. Or, you know, if they subsequently get an illness, then they get retested. So that sort of community engagement is really important in these public health measures.
Absolutely.
You know, we've seen that historically as well. We've seen that historically as well with things like HIV, these sort of grassroots campaigns that really took hold of sort of pushing the cause forward and sort of dealing with the pandemic that was HIV at the time.
Yeah. Okay. I actually do think like this, that kind of movement is really important right now, because one of the other questions I was going to ask was that you mentioned it a bit last week about just the fact that, you know, people have been so kind of sick of like the lockdown's just taken such a heavy mental toll on people that there's really a risk of if you keep locking down that people just become fatigued of it. And there's a whole lot of issues where they, you know, people kind of feel hopeless or, you know, stop trying to, you know, do the safe things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it really is quite important now to have these campaigns.
Mm. That's right. Ensure that everyone's sort of engaged and doing their part, I guess. The other thing that was really interesting, and again, I think, you know, we've talked about the fact that I think words really matter.
Yeah.
We've talked about it previously in the context of naming the virus and sort of the impacts that might have, calling it the China virus, the Wuhan virus, those sorts of things. You know, this week we've seen in the papers the Melbourne virus. It's not particularly helpful.
No.
It's not really true, and it just doesn't help the cause. Oh, but I guess, yeah, again, the message isn't really about social distancing as much as physical distancing. So there are other ways, and we touched on these last time, that you can be social without sort of being in physical contact. And that's really difficult because I think as human beings, we're largely physical. We're social creatures. It's sort of our nature to pat someone on the back or shake their hand, kiss on the cheek, those things in the appropriate context. But, you know, the message really is about physical distancing. But I think from a mental health perspective, it's really important to ensure that we're all remaining connected. And I think as the young generation, we're in a really good position because we have a lot of more experience and familiarity with that technology. But, you know, it's important that, you know, from time to time you pick up the phone and you check in on, you know, parents and, yeah, elderly family members, those sorts of things, to ensure that everyone is sort of connected and feeling that they're still in touch with those around them.
And I guess another question I have is regarding this current situation. This is going to be a difficult question to answer, but given that we're now in another lockdown where there kind of is no end in sight, and given that we just came out of a lockdown, which we thought would be the last one, how do you think this whole situation, just at least in Australia, will end? Do you think that we just continue on in this cycle of repeating lockdowns, or do you think that people will eventually get fed up with it and look for another solution, be that either going for elimination or potentially some people just giving up and taking their chances with the virus?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question and a difficult one to answer. I think, yeah, if I look into my crystal ball, I suspect that, you know, we will contain what's happening currently in Victoria, and, you know, that will take a period of lockdown. There's no doubt about that now, and we're looking at least 6 weeks. And it'll be interesting to see what happens over the next week or two with regards to that sort of plateau and seeing numbers steadily decline back down to hopefully zero. With regards to elimination, we sort of touched on that previously, the benefits and risks associated with each, I guess. I've certainly noticed, particularly amongst the community over the last week, and also within a lot of healthcare workers, growing enthusiasm for an elimination strategy. You know, that's much harder. It's also much harder to maintain, particularly in the absence of a vaccine, but I guess would help to potentially, you know, reduce the risk of future lockdowns like this. You know, we've sort of been quite open all along with a suppression strategy. We would expect outbreaks to occur, and really the key is to identify them, minimize sort of the damage, and then prevent them from happening again. And so, you know, whether there will be a complete shift in policy towards an elimination strategy, I'm not sure. But, you know, there's certainly growing support for that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it does seem quite likely that people would be quite frustrated with, at least at the moment, with the suppression strategy, given that they were told, you know, it would help the economy. And now, because of the way it's gone, it's kind of backfired a bit. And on the, like, flip side, do you think that there is still potential that we could pull off a suppression strategy? That the outbreak we have right now is just simply that we, you know, haven't refined our suppression to be proactive enough, and that maybe if we try it again with new, more proactive measures, suppression could still be an option?
I mean, I think suppression is still on the cards. I can't really speak on the behalf of the government or the Department of Health, but, you know, I guess you've got one or two choices. You either pursue the suppression strategy, and that involves, you know, the risk of future repeated outbreaks, perhaps even a lockdown down the track. And I guess it's important to note that from the start, I think we've all been fairly honest with the idea that, you know, we may need to lock down again, you know, should things get to where they are. And I think they held off. They sort of they acknowledged the impact. You know, the decisions weren't made lightly, but, you know, decisions were sort of made with the best intentions, and that is to try to reduce transmission, reduce the impact on both the population and the healthcare system, and I guess ultimately the economy. It's certainly difficult for I imagine, for small businesses, though, you know, who would just sort of open their doors again. We're seeing clients flowing through those doors, albeit in a physically distant fashion, to now have to close again. And so, you know, important to think about what sort of initiatives need to be put in place to sort of help those businesses survive. You know, I guess the thing, one of the important things to keep in mind is that the numbers are going to get worse before they get better, because we know that there's sort of a 2-week incubation period. And so you would expect that, you know, the numbers will continue to climb before they plateau and then start to fall. And that's one of the other reasons for such a prolonged period of lockdown. And I guess, you know, when we're talking about lockdown, the lockdown measures in Australia or in Victoria are not as harsh as those being seen in some countries. And so I think, you know, the fact that you can still go to the supermarket, you can still go out to exercise, you know, though they're obviously important things for people's mental health and in ongoing engagement in sort of in the response. And so, yeah, I think we will contain this. It's going to take some time. Things are going to look worse before they look better. But I think as a community and as sort of a health workforce, we will get there. And then I guess the decision really lies with what next, and that is, do we continue to pursue suppression, you know, contact trace aggressively, still sort of encourage physical distancing where possible, and then sort of how do we proceed to relaxing those restrictions again, or do we change gears and try to pursue elimination, and then sort of have potentially, you know, countries, states where there are even fewer restrictions, and you could sort of start to open up parts of the world potentially that are COVID-free. And I guess, you know, with that, I think it's important to ensure that, you know, we're still working towards a vaccine. We're still supporting other countries who, you know, perhaps don't have the infrastructure and the resources. I think we've still not yet seen the worst of COVID in Africa. And that's going to be, you know, something really important to see the rest of the world support those countries, because they don't have the robust contact tracing and the infrastructure that we have here in many parts of that continent.
Yeah. And that actually is quite a big issue as well, right? Because as far as a lot of health issues go, people often have a short memory of it, like especially if an issue doesn't directly affect you anymore. Like, for example, we've had multiple Ebola outbreaks in Africa, and Ebola is a much more lethal virus, but, you know, no one's really concerned about it here.
I think, you know, another classic example is, you know, the Spanish flu of 1918 and World War One. No one really talks about the Spanish influenza. I mean, clearly it's getting some airtime at the moment, but no one really talks about the Spanish influenza like they remember World War One. And likewise, you know, there aren't monuments to the Spanish influenza and the people that died from it. You know, it was somewhere between 50 and 100 million people that succumbed to that virus at the time. You know, and there were lots of reasons for that. But you, a relatively small number of people died due to the war, but everyone remembers the war and not the pandemic that followed it. I think, you know, it's right. You know, we need to ensure that we remember and we learn from this experience, and then we use that knowledge and information to sort of ensure that our systems and responses to future pandemics are even better.
Yeah. And so I guess I did ask this last time as well, but do you think that because we've had to use a lot of these systems in and like develop our response to COVID as it's gone on, for example, with the whole now the mask policy and everything, do you think that these would make us more ready for a future pandemic?
I mean, I think, you know, for a number of years now, we've been developing systems for pandemics. And I guess the expectation up until this point was that it would probably be a flu pandemic. But I think people really thought that it would be a coronavirus pandemic.
I did have another question. This is quite like epidemiology heavy. And also, like, there's not much data on this, so I don't know if you can answer it. But do you think, because like coronavirus is not correct, COVID-19 specifically, like SARS-CoV-2, it's so contagious, right? Because it's can be spread while asymptomatic, and its R numbers just tends out to be very high. Do you think that like some of the issues of our response are caused by the fact that we treat it as a flu? Like, for example, this localized response, we were kind of locking down areas as cases appeared, when you might almost consider locking down where you think the virus should be because of the whole incubation period.
This is the idea about being reactive rather versus proactive, right? And I think it's difficult, right? Because you then need to have really good and robust prediction systems as well. You know, I think some key differences between this and flu include the long incubation period. So we know that so the 95% confidence interval for incubation period is about 2 to 11.5 days. And so with, you know, with only 1% of people developing symptoms beyond 14 days, potentially, you know, roughly. And so I guess, you know, you have to be 2 weeks ahead of the game, right? I guess the other big difference is that, you know, there's also this sort of bimodal illness as well. And so, you know, your numbers go up and then your mortality goes up about a week later, I guess is another sort of key factor in this. And, you know, but in terms of, you know, are we managing this like a flu? I guess, you know, they do have things in common. You know, they're both still respiratory viruses. They're largely spread by the droplet route. And so there are sort of key commonalities that mean that some of the measures that can be taken against flu will work against COVID-19 as well. But I think, you know, it's important to recognize those other differences, and they are like the long incubation period, the sort of second phase of the illness, those things that make them actually quite different.
Yeah. Actually, so when you say bimodal disease, is that kind of referring to like temporally like the first phase and second phase in one patient, or the fact that it can appear either as mild or severe in different people?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about bimodal in the single patient. So you look like, you know, patient develops symptoms, they might look like they're getting better or they might progressively deteriorate, but they shift from sort of that initial viral mediated illness, where sort of the illness is largely driven by the effects of the virus and the acute immune response to it, to being a predominantly inflammatory response, an inflammatory syndrome, which can lead to, you know, acute respiratory distress syndrome and the various other sequelae, coagulopathies and things that have also been noticed.
Okay, so basically a lot of those secondary or late phase kind of symptoms like acute respiratory distress syndrome and coagulopathy, that's all thought to be like body mediated.
Yeah, so it's thought to be an sort of an inflammatory mediated syndrome that is triggered by coronavirus. And there's all sorts of theories as to why that might occur, which include, you know, it being a virus that's predominantly, you know, adapted to another species and its immune system. And so when it comes into our immune system recognizes the response to it quite differently.
Yeah. And is that kind of like why drugs like dexamethasone might have an effect?
Yeah. So I guess that's the idea, right? That it's an immunosuppressing agent. And so it makes sense that it would have some effect if it's a predominantly inflammatory syndrome. And likewise, you know, things like tocilizumab, the R6 monoclonal antibody, have effect in COVID-19 as well. And it's predominantly their anti-inflammatory effects, you know, which offer them benefit, we think.
And so just if those things are kind of caused by abnormalities in like systems that are already in the body, there that sounds like there would be quite a bit of room to, you know, for drug developments or, you know, things other than a specific vaccine that can recognize this virus that could still be effective. There's room that you could use existing like anti-inflammatories or anticoagulants, you know, with enough clinical experience.
No, that's right. And I mean, those sorts of things are being looked at, you know, so other monoclonal antibodies are being trialed, you know, other sort of steroid sparing immunosuppressants being sort of looked into, routine anticoagulation is being discussed, and there's some data already for it, particularly in those who are critically unwell in ICU because of the high incidence of things like, you know, venous thromboembolism. Yeah, you know, but the data is not strong enough to sort of warrant its widespread use. And so, yeah, there's definitely room for trials in, you know, utilizing existing therapies, particularly for COVID, and be they directly, you know, related to modifying the course of COVID or even just in improving care of patients with COVID, right? So if you know that venous thromboembolism is a complication of COVID, we have robust means of preventing that in hospitals. And so ensuring that people are on DVT prophylaxis, those sorts of things, is also really crucial in terms of both treating the COVID, but also improving the care of the patient with COVID. They're two sort of separate but interrelated things. And so while the quest is ultimately for a directly acting antiviral agent that can, you know, reduce mortality, reduce hospital length of stay, reduce disease severity, and potentially even, you know, work as a post-exposure prophylaxis or a pre-exposure prophylaxis to prevent transmission in the absence of a vaccine. There's also extensive room for investigation of novel therapies or, you know, existing therapies in improving the care of patients with COVID at the various stages of the illness.
That actually sounds quite promising and hopeful, right? Because, I mean, of course, it's all tentative, but regardless of how the quest for a specific effective vaccine or antiviral turns out, in the meantime, we will probably be able to better treat patients with severe disease, at least, you know, if nothing else, but to reduce mortality and, like, complications.
That's right. And I guess the other information that all, you know, that is starting to emerge is what happens to patients who have had COVID. What are the long-term consequences of having infection with SARS-CoV-2? We don't really know that yet, but, you know, concerns around its effects on cognition and sort of this sort of chronic inflammatory lung disease, you know, they're all really important considerations as well, is that, you know, how are we going to best care for these patients when all of this is hopefully over? You know, we're still going to be left with a population of people who have been affected by this either, you know, directly by viral infection or sort of affected secondarily because they've lost their job, they've lost their livelihood, they've spent, you know, several months in lockdown. Like, we have to be prepared to deal with all of those different sort of situations. And so one of the key sort of messages throughout all of this is how, as healthcare workers and a community, we've had to be sort of adaptive and agile. You know, I think we're going to have to continue, even when COVID-19 is finished, you know, that we still have to have sort of robust systems in place to ensure that we're able to provide care for those who have been affected by it.
Okay. So its effects will be felt for, you know, long after it's, I mean, hopefully after it's gone.
Potentially, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And so do you think moving forward from this pandemic, are there any kind of silver linings, any positives that have come out of this pandemic?
What are the positives that have come of COVID? I guess it's provided an opportunity to actually, you know, to put into practice some of these systems that have been developed to ensure that they actually work in terms of mitigating the risk of spread. It's obviously, you know, it garners an entire generation of clinicians with and people with that experience some, I guess, inadvertent side effects of the pandemic have been that we simply haven't seen the same numbers of flu cases as we might otherwise have seen. We'd expect about 3,500 to 4,000 cases of flu by this time every year. And the numbers that we have seen are only about 10% of what we'd expected by this point in time. And some of that might be that we're actually not testing as much for flu, but it also, the fact that we are socially distancing and not importing flu has probably contributed to that a little bit as well, well, somewhat as well. Other, I guess, side effects that come of this is that, as a people, as I mentioned earlier, it sort of gives us a common enemy, and so can help to bring people from different sides of politics or different sides of sort of, the Australian community or different parts of the Australian community together, because we're all sort of, we've all been in this together. We've all sort of had the experience of lockdown. We've all had the experience of going to the supermarket and potentially not being able to access the things that we would usually take for granted. And so there's that sort of unity which comes from a shared experience as well, not to mention all the sort of scientific gains that we've learned about sort of coronavirus immunology, virology, sort of tracking outbreaks in healthcare settings or in the community using sort of novel molecular technologies that we didn't have 20 or 30 years ago to sort of to put into place. So lots of sort of potential benefits that could have come from COVID-19.
So what do you think are going to be some changes to the healthcare system, at least in Australia, especially for medical students who are graduating in a few years' time?
So I think, one clear part of the healthcare system that coronavirus has helped to expedite is the more widespread availability and utilization of telehealth. Essentially around coronavirus, hospital outpatient clinics almost stopped in their tracks in a lot of instances. And so a lot of that sort of consultation and day-to-day care of patients in an outpatient setting actually moved toward, telephone consultation or video consultation in hospitals, but also with general practitioners, and in order to allow that to happen, there were structural changes at a sort of federal level to enable that to be funded, which, perhaps were a long time coming. At the same time, other sequelae, that for a period of time there, people were avoiding hospitals. And so you kind of wonder what the implications of that are going to be long term. So, seeing people present later with chronic health conditions like heart disease, like, malignancy, rather than sort of presenting early, people are going to present, several months down the track with something that could have been treated very differently had it been detected much earlier. And so I think we're still, again, going to learn what the impacts of that are going to be. That's something that medical students, the next generation of doctors, are potentially going to have to continue to sort of work with.
Right.
Around medical students, it's also had impacts on medical student education and opportunities for education. Lectures which would previously have been in a lecture theatre have been delivered online. Bedside teaching has had to be adapted to smaller groups and in some instances cancelled. Examination likewise has in some instances moved to more of a telehealth model. So it's sort of it forced us to revisit some of these long-held sort of structures and adapt to the current climate. Some of that hopefully will be for the benefit, of medical students, because we don't necessarily need to deliver everything in large lecture theatres. Why can't we have lectures online where you can learn from the comfort of your sort of study or bedroom or something? There's no need to travel long distances for education.
Well, I guess, from my own experience and some of my peers, the online learning thing may or may not be ideal. I think there's room there, but there's pros and cons. But definitely, you know, some of the other examples you were talking about, like the telehealth, that is definitely an example of something getting better. You know, we're able to see a doctor more easily, which hopefully should help with screening of diseases and, you know, identifying problems sooner.
So, but perhaps, I mean, another benefit that seems obvious of telehealth is that, you know, people in regional and rural areas can now have access in some capacity to specialists in the city. And I mean, these systems have been sort of developed over a long period of time, but it's, I guess, coronavirus or COVID-19 has sort of helped to expedite some formalization and sort of increased uptake of those technologies by both patients and healthcare systems.
All right. I think that's all the time that we've got today, unfortunately. I might just ask you one last question just to close things off. So just in your job as an ID specialist, both just regularly and during this time, what has been, first of all, the most difficult part of, like, the most difficult situation you've had to deal with? And what has been the most rewarding part of your job?
I think one of the most difficult things as an ID specialist or as a fellow working with coronavirus has been the uncertainty. People obviously look to you as an expert in the field. And at times you sort of feel that perhaps you know as much or perhaps even a little less than they do. You know, we live in a highly connected world where data flows fairly freely. And, you know, often patients are well educated. Other clinicians are well educated, and they come to you with quite curly questions at times. And you, the expectation is that you're the specialist in that field. And so that's been quite challenging at times to sort of navigate the sort of that uncertainty and acknowledge that uncertainty when discussing this with colleagues. Although, you know, we do that routinely. You know, it's okay to say that you don't know something. But I guess, you know, as ID specialists, we've sort of trained in some of the fundamentals around sort of infection control, management of viral pneumonitis, so that we still have experience in these sorts of things, but still, like, the some of the, you know, the nuances of the data, you know, we weren't immediately specialists in. And so we had to sort of get up to speed quite quickly, I guess. In terms of what the most rewarding part has been is seeing some of these systems put into effect and work, to see patients get better, to see patients leave hospital. That's always the goal, to see the numbers go down, to see the curves flatten. They're sort of the rewards. And sometimes amongst that uncertainty that, that, you know, patients get better and what the systems that you put into place have worked.
All right. It's definitely been a pleasure talking about this. It's a very, you know, interesting and, you know, constantly changing topic. Thank you very much for having this talk with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the AMSA Ampule Podcast's M2.0 series. Our code word for this week is brunch, that meal that you hang out with friends over. If you go to our website, www.m2020.com.au, and insert the code word in our portal, you will go into the running for some great prizes and giveaways. And over the course of our series, you will be able to collect an image per week for our M20 sticker book. The M2.0 series is a subset of AMPUL, the Australian Medical Student Association's ongoing podcast series to highlight speakers who would have presented at our 2020 AMSA National Convention. If you would like to learn more about our podcast, you can visit our website www.m2020.com.au or our parent website www.amsa.org.au. Or, if you prefer, we are on social media as the AMSA Ampule Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. For information of topics covered in this podcast, you can reach out to AMSA Special Interest Groups on Facebook, Instagram, and on the AMSA website. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of our speakers and do not definitively represent those of AMSA or their subsidiaries. If you would like to know more about our public policies, please visit our website at www.amsa.org.au and select Advocacy, followed by Official Policy. This episode of Ampule was hosted and edited by Ray Shen, with guests David Griffin, music by James Pomier, and credits by Nick Barrett.